very general ground saying a couple of things about theories where the fields are large N matrices. We used matrix models, which are models where we don't have space-time because it simplifies our life, but I want again to emphasize that what was important in all this discussion and in the tutorial, all these pictures you were drawing, it was not crucial that if each vertex had a space-time label or not. What was crucial is how they are connected, how the lines go, and so on, right? So the idea in this large N theory is the natural observables to consider are single-trace operators, okay? They are the natural observables for two reasons. The reason number one is because they are gauge invariant. For example, if you multiply several of them, if you have a space-time, you should multiply them all at the same point x. Why? Because under a gauge transformation, these fields transform under omega of x from the left, omega minus 1 of x from the right. So if you want to have a gauge invariant object, they better be all at the same point x. And in general, you could have several fields. You don't need to have just one matrix M. You can have a matrix M, another matrix N, another matrix P. You can have different kinds of matrices. You could have an action, for example, which would be the actions we were seeing for a matrix M, plus an action similar for a matrix N, plus some interaction term, trace of M squared N squared. Which would mean that in your theory, there would be a vertex like this, where these red things would be matrices of type N, and the white things would be matrices of type M. And you would start drawing graphs. And now your graphs would be not only graphs like this, but parts of it would be white, parts of it would be red, depending on whether M or N matrices are propagating. This would be kind of an extra complication. Do you agree? Very good. So what's important is not whether you can have different kinds of fields. It's clear that you can. Whether you are in zero dimensions or in more dimensions, that's okay. You can also put them in different dimensions. But what was crucial was this combinatorics here of how you start drawing the graphs. And there are several ways of doing it. The most conventional one is to think of each trace of an operator to some power, we draw a star with L lines getting out of that point. That's the most conventional one. And we fatten the lines a little bit because each field is a matrix, it has two indices, so it's useful to fatten each line into fat vertices and fat propagators. Another way that I want to use sometimes is to think of it in this way, where each vertex, I opened it up, but I have to keep in mind that it was a vertex originally. So these lines between this, I don't think of them as propagators. And this, I don't think of it as a vertex, a three vertex. This is all an object. It's the same thing. This is a just notation for that. And this notation, I find it easier to draw. If I have L fields, I just draw 1, 2, dot, 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 L. Whereas there, if I have 7 fields, I never know how much I should open up each angle. And it becomes a mess very quickly. And another way you can think of this is as a ring. As a circle where you put points on it. Because a trace of a product of fields is just a cyclic object. You have M1, M2, M3, right? And you can just rotate it. M, N, P, I can rotate and put N, P, and M at the end. So it's a cyclic object, right? I can represent it as a circle, where on the circle I insert my matrices, matrix at position, the first one, the second one, up to the Lth one. And then I contract these two circles, making a cylinder. Of course, all these pictures are equivalent. So from the first one, I draw this diagram on the sphere. And here I'm summing the diagrams. And if I sum the diagrams, for example, I could bring two cubic vertices from the action and draw this, which we would call a two-loop interaction. It would be a bunch of particles. They throw a mediator at each other. And after a while, they throw another mediator at each other. Okay? So this could be 5 gluons propagating in space-time. The first two gluons exchange a gluon, and the next two gluons exchange a gluon. Okay? If this was a QCD. Here is the same picture. Here are the 5 gluons coming in. The first, these two change a gluon, these two change a gluon. And here is the same picture, where now we highlight the fact that this is a cyclic object, namely that this last index and this index are the same, as indicated by this line. We can draw this picture like this, you see, where we keep track of the double line notation. And these 5 particles are coming in, and these are exchanging. It's more kind of a 3D picture. It's probably the one I like the most, but it's often a bit hard to draw. So often I will stick to the middle one. It's a compromise. And they are all equivalent, right? So if I think of this on a sphere, and I excise a small dot, 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 dot here, just because this is an insertion of an operator, then this would correspond to this to a cylinder. Then I would get a cylinder where the two dot, 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 dots would be these two lines here, right? So a sphere is a cylinder. A cylinder is a sphere with two small circles removed. And then there are the non-planar graphs, which would be the graphs where this gluon decides to interact not with a neighbor, but with a gluon far away. Those graphs are suppressed by 1 over n squared. Okay? So what we saw is that this sum of graphs likes to organize itself by topologies. So it's convenient to organize all graphs that I can draw on the cylinder plus all graphs for which I need at least one hole, plus all graphs for which I need at least two holes, and so on and so forth. And these graphs come, the higher the genus, the more suppressed they are. But that's pretty much the definition of a string theory. So we recognize here a string theory where we have some string coupling, which tells me that it's more and more suppressed to create holes, that is to split strings. And then we expect that this sum over all Feynman diagrams, the sum over exchanging two gluons or putting here an extra gluon or an extra one here and an extra one here, all this sum should be somehow related to summing over all possible surfaces for a given fixed topology. Let's put here below the integral fixed genus. For a given fixed genus, we integrate over all surfaces with that topology, some string action, and there should be some string tension. And our intuition tells us that the relation should be something like the tension should be lambda or square root of lambda or lambda squared, something that when lambda is big, the tension is big and the classical solutions are dominated. Whereas if the lambda is very small, we expect this tension to be very small because this doesn't look yet like a string theory, which should be the intuition that the string can fluctuate a lot. In other words, you just have these 5 lines going vertically. If you don't put any interaction, these lines can go anywhere and so on. Before connecting from the bottom to the top, the string has very little tension. Okay. So this was all hand-waving. And continuing along this hand-waving spirit, we also said that this also looks like a spin chain. Especially if I would have, for example, 2 kinds of fields where I could have some yellow, some white, some red, some white, some red. It looks really like up, down, up, down, up, down. And then as I'm studying the propagation of this spin chain, which is like its time evolution, which is like its energy, because this is how things evolve, it looks like this interaction start to be generated by Feynman diagrams. But because of the planar nature of my theory, because the gluon can only interact with a neighbor, can only interact with a neighbor, and so on, it looks like there should be some relation also between these large end theories and spin chains. Spin chains that could be like our favorite Heisenberg spin chain with nearest neighbors if we are doing just 1 loop. But if we are doing 2 loops already, like in that picture, it would already be next to nearest neighbor interactions involving 3 nearest neighbors. And then as I continue increasing perturbation theory, the spin chain becomes more and more non-local. And perhaps then the correct description would be that of a string theory. So this was yesterday. Any question?
I think that should be GS to the 2 to -2.
Sorry, can you repeat? GS?
To the power of 2 to -2.
Ah, good point. Yeah, that's right. Sorry. Well, the typo here. Yeah. Yeah, the string is small, so higher genus are more suppressed. Well, if it was n squared, it would be OK.
So when you're interpreting it as a string theory, you're integrating over all surfaces. But what are these surfaces in that picture?
Yeah, this is schematic, of course. I mean, we have to understand it. This is not a given. Given a theory, it's very hard to find in general what the surface is. I'm just saying that there should be something like that. I have here, these are the initial conditions. This is where it starts. This is where it goes. And then the claim is that all these graphs look like a surface already. You see, imagine I put here 1,000,000 of this. Of these orange lines. Doesn't it look already like a nice surface? A mathematician might not buy this, I'm not sure. But yeah. Good. So now the idea is to try to slowly start making this more precise. And today, for example, I will show you a sharp connection between spin chain Hamiltonians and large n gauge theories. So today we will work mostly on this last point, especially given that we went through some effort to familiarize ourselves with spin chains. It's useful now to tap on that knowledge by connecting it with gauge theories. Okay. So the first thing we should keep in mind is that this is, of course, these hand-waving arguments are naive at many, many levels. I mean, you can definitely poke holes on it from all possible directions. But one thing that you could say immediately is that what are you saying that you have some coupling lambda and you tune it to be small, you tune it to be big, and so on. Typically, it's not up to you. Typically, you have some coupling, you have some renormalization, and depending on what energy scale you are, you will find what coupling you are. QCD is free at very high energies, and it's strongly coupled at weak energies, and it's not up to us to go to the lab and say, let me make the quarks be free. Right? It's not up to me. So when could it be up to me? Well, it could be up to me if I have a theory for which I have a parameter lambda, a coupling that I can tune, a coupling that does not run, that has a zero beta function, and that I have the freedom, a continuous parameter that I have the freedom to tune. So I want a theory for which I have the freedom of tuning this parameter lambda, which is a theory that does not have a scale, and that allows me to have a lambda, which is called the marginal parameter that I can tune and go all the way from the theory being weakly coupled to strongly coupled.
Yes? What you really mean then is that you have a parameter that you can tune and the dynamics remains unchanged, because in any, whenever I have an energy flow, I always tune along relevant directions. Of course, I'll have different vacuums along every point. So you're saying that you want something.
Yeah, I want rather a theory where I can study correlation functions. I can study what is the correlation function of this operator and this operator, and I have a family of theories parameterized by a parameter where I don't change my observable, I keep my observable, and I change a parameter that tells me whether this is well described by gluons that move freely from here to here, or by a very interacting dynamics that of things going on from here to here. Okay. So a theory that is a great candidate for us to start our explorations, which is the theory that I'm going to introduce next, is, let me think if I want to introduce right away the theory or first be a bit more general. One second. Now let me introduce the theory. And then you will see that what I'm saying is actually much more general than this particular theory. But there's no point in trying to keep it general. It's good to have one particular example in mind. But what I'm going to say for a good while will be very, very general. The theory I want to introduce now is a gauge theory, a special one, called n equals 4 super Young Mills in 4 dimensions. Okay. So I should, of course, tell you, I should, of course, emphasize that all this stuff is typically very hard to make precise. And although I think all ideas I said are correct as they are, no one found yet what is the string theory dual for QCD, for example. So people believe they have phenomenological models, models with some free parameters that they try to tune to match as good as well as possible the spectrum that you observe in the lattice, but it's a tough business. Finding what is exactly the correct theory of for these effective strings that emerge is a very tough business. Okay. But there are examples like this one where people believe that they understood it, where people believe that we know what is the exact string description, and I can really write this with as precise as you want. I can really tell you what is this section, what is this T of lambda. I can really tell you what is the map, and how can you forget about four dimensions and go to string theory, or forget about string theory and go to four dimensions. There are some awesome examples like that, and I want to introduce one of them, which relates this theory, n equals 4 super Young Mills, to a particular string theory that we will see next week. Okay? Now, this four-dimensional Young Mills theory is a theory that is easier to think of as coming from n equals 1, so a theory with less supersymmetry, super Young Mills in 10 dimensions, compactified down to 4 dimensions. Okay? So of course, you start seeing these 10 dimensions, it already starts smelling a little bit like string theory. And indeed, this is exactly the low energy dynamics that you get from string theory. If you take a stack of brains, like this piece of paper, you take a stack of brains which are in 3 dimensions plus 1 of time, so they are a stack of D3 brains, And you have some open strings attached to these D3 brains. So this originally, these open strings, they know that they are in 10 dimensions, but they are attached to this D3 brain. So there will be some low energy description that will be a four-dimensional description at 2+1, which will live on the brain for the degrees of freedom of the brain. And that description of the excitations of the brain, as you saw in the string theory course, is given by gauge bosons and so on. It's given by gauge theories, and this is what this N=4 super Young Mills is. So it's a theory that describes the low energy dynamics of a stack of D3 brains. So the simplest thing, if you want to take string theory and get an effective theory in four dimensions, is you just put some brains and say, we are on the brain. So we cannot leave the brain, so we are in this four-dimensional spacetime. So you put there, you take a low energy limit, and you see what's the effective theory, and you get N=4 super Young Mills. But because string theory likes 10 dimensions, this theory is a four-dimensional theory that smells 10-dimensional in many, many aspects, as we will see. Okay? It really, you look at it and you say, wait, this come from 10 dimensions, as you will see. It will become very clear. So what is this theory? This one is very simple. It is just, there is Fmn, Fmn. So this is just pure glue in 10 dimensions. And it's supersymmetric, so then there are fermions. Plus psi bar d slash psi. It is just this theory. You have some fermions. These fermions are 16 component real spinners. And that's it. This is the theory. And you compactify it back to four dimensions. But before I do it, let me just make sure that people understand what this notation means. So just to be sure, let me write very, very explicitly. I like doing this exercise. When I have this, what is this? Let me write this with all gory detail, all possible indices, such that we make sure that we all understand what this is. What do we mean by this? So this, let me tell you what this is. So this is the following. So I have psi bar, which has some spinner index A, and is a matrix, so it has indices ij. Right? We are in an unabelian gauge theory. These fields, they are all in the adjoint, so they are all matrices. So these psi's are matrices, so psi ij. Then we have the slash, which means that we contracted a gamma matrix. So we have gamma matrix M with the spinner indices AB. Then we have the derivative. So we have derivative with respect to M, okay, of psi B, the other spinner, which itself, okay, I'm going to write at the end, which this psi B is itself a matrix. I'm going to put the indices of this matrix at the end, J, and it's JK, but it's JI, because we take the trace. And then it's a covariant derivative, so there is plus I commutator of the gauge field AM with psi B. Again, they are matrices, you multiply them and so on, and then you take JI. Okay? Where these are 10-dimensional gamma matrices, so this guy, so big gamma M, gamma N plus gamma N, gamma M equal twice eta MN times the identity in spinner space. So you see, we write this nice notation, which you have in mind. It's not totally a totally trivial object. So this I, let's make sure we understand this. I, j, runs from 1 to the number of colors. This is what will be our large parameter. The spinner indices, A, B, run from 1 to 16, as we said. The space-time indices, M, N, because we are in 10 dimensions, run from 1 to 10. Or maybe from 0 to 9. I don't know. What do you prefer? Let's put 0 to 9. And that's it. OK? So this is just an example. so that we understand what theory we are talking about. And trace of FMN is trivial. There's nothing to explain. FMN is defined as derivative of A minus derivative of A plus the commutator, exactly like we did when we defined this flatness of our flat connection, right? We had a connection, we construct an F, remember, so it's the same non-abelian F that we constructed there. So now, let's see what happens when we compactify to four dimensions. So as we go from 10 dimensions to four dimensions, it's very easy to do. That's why it's always convenient to think of the action in this way, because this way you don't forget. You just say it's F squared plus psi d psi. Right, so this is that's the simplest action you could write. It's just you have gluons plus fermions, and you never forget. But then as you compactify, you see that you generate some terms that are a bit harder to memorize. So it's always nice to think in this way. So let's see what we get when we compactify from 10D to 4D. So what does it mean? We just write the action, and we postulate that fields do not depend on the position x4 up to x9. We say it only depends on x0 up to x3. Right? So the fields are on these brains that have x0 up to x3, and we just say they don't depend on the rest. Okay? And we also separate, it's convenient, as you will see, to separate the gauge field AM into some A mu and some phi I, where this mu takes the first values, 0 up to 3, and this I takes the values 4 up to 9. Okay, it's so just notation. We'll see now it's going to be useful. Because then, you see, let's see what happens with this FMN, FMN. Well, if both indices are in four dimensions, this just gives F mu nu, F mu nu. Right? Now, if one index is in four dimensions and the other index is in the orthogonal directions, if one index is in the direction that is compactified, what you get is plus, let me write and then you will see if you agree, d mu phi I d mu phi I, where this derivative of phi I is the covariant derivative, is d phi I, is this. You see that if I put here a phi, it looks indeed like the component of the field strength. Okay, so please look at me to see if you realize, but what term do you forget? You forget derivative with respect to the other directions of A, but those are zero because we said the field doesn't depend on those. So this is indeed what the other components mu I are. They miss just derivative with respect to I, which nothing depends on I, of a mu. So of course, that's zero. And then there is the other one where we put here ij. When we put ij, now the derivatives of the scalar with respect to I and to j don't exist, so we don't have derivative. So out of the field strength, we just take the commutator. Okay? So plus the commutator of phi I phi j times the commutator of phi I phi j. And we trace over this. These are all matrices and we trace. What about the fermions? Psi bar d slash psi. Well, they separate into psi bar gamma mu d mu psi plus commutator of a mu psi. This is if the index mu is. This is if the index mu in this covariant derivative is in the direction 0 to 3. And if it's in the other directions, I can ignore the derivative. So I get what people call a Yukawa term. We get psi gamma I psi. Okay. And if you add up all this, Now you add up these two lines, right? And what you get is n equals 4 super young mu. Okay? So this is the action for n equals 4 super young mu. So I could have written this action right away. You see that this action, it's now an action that now you write, you take this, you integrate, you put here a coupling, 1 over g string, or it's usually convenient to denote this coupling as 1 over g young mu square. You take a trace, and you put all this thing here. And this is our action. I could have given you this action right away. This is an action, you see? What I wanted to emphasize, I forgot to write. d4x. Here is an action in four dimensions, and so on, and this is what the action is. But you see that if I was given you this action, it would be a bit suspicious. Well, where did all these terms come from? They really smell like 10 dimensions. You see, it's an action where you have a psi that depends on four dimensions, but then some gamma matrices with a 10-dimensional representation would appear here. Right? Why not? I could do it, but it looks weird. It looks like these fermions want to live in 10 dimensions. These gamma matrices are the 10-dimensional gamma matrices that obey the 10-dimensional gamma algebra, this one plus that one. And then you would see this kind of term that clearly resemble like they came from some reduction of some field strength term, and indeed that's what they do. This is what precisely these terms are. Okay? So this is the theory I wanted to introduce. Yes?
So when you go to four dimensions, the roles of the field there, I don't see why they would all be the same. I mean, would some of the phis become like scalars and the interactions and stuff like that? Or do they all stay as spinners and vector fields?
That's good. Yeah. So now this guy behave as scalar. And this become the four-dimensional gauge fields, gauge bosons. Okay? Namely, let's see that. That's a good point. So normally, AM, right, will transform as omega AM omega minus 1 plus omega DM omega minus 1, right? But now you see that if the index M is mu, then it's fine. But the infinity M is I, we said that nothing depends on I, so we get just that phi. So now this will be okay for mu. A mu goes to similar stuff. But for phi, we will now get that phi I transforms just with omega phi I omega minus 1 like a scalar. Like a scalar in a gauge theory. A joint scalar in a gauge theory. Okay? And psi would be the same. Psi. Okay? So this would be the gauge transformations. Yes, Tom?
Okay, I'm totally not sure with, like, you're saying that reduce the 10 dimensions down to 4 dimensions to get many equals of the angles. I'm not familiar with this theory. Why is it that the phis have to have 6 components and the gamma matrices have to be 10 dimensional?
That's because we started with this theory.
That's just the way it is.
So we started the theory, which is n equals 1 in 10 dimensions. So this theory has many things that, it's 10 dimensional. So the gamma matrices are 10 dimensional. There are 10 fields, 10 components of the gauge field, and so on. When you compactify, it will lead to a special theory. It's not a random theory. It has 6 scalars. It cannot have 4 scalars. It cannot have 3 scalars. It has 6. Why? Because it came from 10 dimensions. It has some funny gamma matrices which transform in the representation of 10-dimensional gamma matrices. It cannot be another one because it comes from 10 dimensions. That's how the construction goes. And the fact that it comes from 10 dimensions, it's because it comes from string theory, if you want.
Right, I'm just wondering about like saying where n equals 4 super young mu comes from apart from this compactification procedure.
Yeah, there is also many other ways of understanding. This is also the theory which has maximal supersymmetry. And if you try to write down what's the theory with maximal supersymmetry, you are left to this as the unique option.
With 6 gauge bosons.
Yeah. Okay. But it's a bit tougher to see. More questions?
Yes. Did you say the gamma matrices were 10-dimensional?
They are the 10-dimensional representation. They are, of course, 16-dimensional, 16 by 16.
Okay.
Right? So these guys, as we said, the index AB go from 1 to 16. right? So normally it goes from what? It's something like this, right? Something like this, right? So when this 10, 2 to the 5, is it 16? Please be 16. Is? No? Oh my God.
Because there's minus 1. So this is the dimension of a gamma matrix, right? The minimal one. Okay.
So now, a couple of simple statements about this theory. We are going to study single trace operators. So what we will study are operators, that depend on a given point in space-time. So this is a point in four-dimensional Minkowski space. What are they? They are, as we said, trace, have products of fields. Let me call these fields M, these matrices, M1, ML, all evaluated at the same point in position space X. Okay? Where this M can be what? This M can be a scalar, phi I, or it could be a fermion, psi, or it cannot be a gauge glue, a gauge boson. Gauge boson is not a gauge invariant observable. A gauge boson does not transform nicely. You see, it transforms as omega A, omega minus 1 plus some junk, and we don't like it. But it could be F mu nu. F mu nu is fine. F mu nu transforms as omega F mu nu, omega minus 1. That's why we construct F mu nu. Right? So this would be good. It could also be covariant derivative of phi I. It could also be two covariant derivatives of phi I, etc. Many things it could be. Okay? Good. And we know, I remind you, that if we consider that these are the building blocks, because as we saw yesterday, if we consider, for example, these two guys at the position X and these two guys at position Y, this will factorize into a propagation. This will factorize. And in large N gauge theory, single trace operators are the building blocks as the strings that we are getting are free strings. So these are the objects we are going to focus on. So this are what are called single trace gauge invariant operators. Now, an important statement is that lambda, which is G Young Mill square N, is a free parameter in this theory. It's your choice. It doesn't run. Typically, when you write, for example, the action of pure glue, you write 1 over G Young Mills times F square. This G Young Mills is nothing. You don't care about this G Young Mills. You know that from this action, you will generate glue balls. You will generate some mass. And that mass is the physical thing that you measure things then in terms of this glue mass. And this G just becomes under RG dynamically transmuted into this mass M. And it's not up to you to choose G. You just let G flow and you see what G is. Is it okay? But here, we can tune our parameter. If we ask, we write this section, and then we think in the usual way. We think that this section has some kinetic terms and some vertices. And now what happens under RG? The couplings of the vertices could start flowing with energy scale. And furthermore, I could generate mass terms. The scalars and fermions and so on that are all massless could become massive. Is it clear? And then I ask myself, is the beta function 0? Which would mean that these couplings do not actually run and are not generated, and they stay as it is, and lambda is a parameter. And the claim is that this is precisely the claim, that in n equals 4 super Young Mills, the beta function is 0 non-perturbatively. Okay. So it is a theory that does not acquire a scale. So this is a theory without scale. You see, everyone is massless, and there are G, nothing flows. You don't have a scale. So it's a theory. There is no natural distance. There is no scale. All scales are the same. If something happens at some distance, it happens at twice that distance. These are what people call conformal field theories. So it's a conformal field theory. Or a CFT. Now, in a theory without a scale, so let's consider a CFT with a single field phi. It's not at all what we have here. We have many, many fields. We can build many things. Let's simplify a little bit. We have a theory without a scale with a single field phi. And then we consider what are correlation functions of phi at some point x and phi at some point y. And we said that there is no scale, so we cannot build dimensionless quantities out of x minus y. So this should depend only on x minus y, of course, by rotational symmetry, if we are considering a reasonable theory. But there's nothing we can build out of x minus y, which has no dimension. So we cannot build non-trivial functions of x minus y. All we can do is write that this should be some constant that we don't care about. And then there can be some power law, x minus y to some power. And this critical exponent is called the dimension of the field phi. In other words, fields have dimensions, right? For example, if you have a field in your action, which is in four dimensions, these scalars, they have dimension one, because derivative plus scalar plus scalar is equal to four. So then, for example, if you have a free theory, this delta, if this phi is a scalar, and if you are in four dimensions, this delta is one. This is just a classical dimension. But then at the quantum level, this field could acquire a quantum dimension that could shift this value. And all we are saying here is dimensional analysis. If this object has mass dimension delta and so has this, and if I want to consider a quantity which has total mass dimension 2 delta and that depends on x minus y, this is the only thing I can write. Right? So this is just dimensional analysis here. Right? So I have no scale, and without any scale, I need to construct a quantity of dimension delta plus delta. Okay, that's the only thing I can write. Is it clear? So in a CFT, computing these deltas, the set of all deltas, is what is called the spectrum of the CFT. And as you see, it's the most natural first question you can ask. What are all possible sets of deltas? What are all possible sets of dimensions in my CFT? It's the first important property of a CFT. That is, the different correlators, what is their falloff? What is the correlation function of this operator? Now, how do we compute this quantity in practice? So let me tell you how do we do it in practice. In practice, it's not totally trivial to compute this. Let's suppose there is some perturbation theory, okay? And let's suppose that our action for our phi is some free action plus some small interaction. Then how does it work in practice? Typically, we start and we say that we have phi of x, phi of y. And now I want to put here an index bare to indicate that I start with the fields of my bare Lagrangian. So now we are going to do a bit of renormalization. Okay. So you all heard about renormalization in the courses, right? So I'm just going to remind you a little bit to set a bit the notation. So we start with the bare fields of the Lagrangian, and we compute correlation function between x minus y. Now, if lambda is zero, we get just the propagator, 1 over x minus y to the power 1 over 2 delta 0, where this delta 0 is just the classical dimension. For example, delta 0 would be equal to 1 for scalars in 4 dimensions. Okay, scalar in 4 dimensions, the kinetic term, d phi squared, so phi is dimension 1. And then we start doing perturbation theory, so we get 1 plus lambda dot dot dot. Okay, so let me tell you what is this dot dot dot. What would you typically get? And then we will see it on the example of n equals 4, which is a more sophisticated example, that we do get that. By the way, today we will go over time a little bit. So what will happen in perturbation theory? What will be this dot, dot, dot in a CFT? So if it's not a CFT, many things can happen. For example, you can start getting terms proportional to cutoff square when you are doing perturbation theory, if you introduce some cutoff. Those are the typical terms. If you get a term with cutoff square, that you would absorb in mass renormalization. You would just say, oh, but my bare mass was not a physical mass. It was an m0 plus cutoff square, or cutoff times some delta m. And this was how we would get rid of it. In a CFT, such terms cannot appear because they have some scale. But what can appear and what does appear is this lambda times this dot, 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 as we will see, can be lambda. Let's parameterize it in this way. Let me write it like this. Minus lambda times 2 gamma. So this is a constant that I want to parameterize like this, because I suspect this is the correct way, but I'm not even sure. Perhaps I'll change this sign soon. And then what we typically get is divergences which are logarithmic in a cutoff, if we do things in perturbation theory introducing some cutoff. Okay, so this is some UV cutoff. But of course, this cutoff has dimension. It can appear only if it's multiplied by x minus y. Okay, or you can put here a square, and this is why I remember not having a 2. Okay, x minus y is a distance, it should be square. This is the kind of thing that can appear and will appear if we start doing perturbation theory and start computing now instead of just scalar, we start summing graphs and so on from position x to position y. This is the kind of things that you will generate if you are in a CFT. But now, what you have to do is quite clear. What you have to do is the following. So you say the following. Let's define our phi of x, okay, to be, let me tell you, lambda to the power lambda gamma times our bare field. Which, because we are in perturbation theory, this is the same as 1 plus gamma lambda log of the cutoff times the bare field. But I prefer the first line. And then let's compute what is the correlation function of this phi of x with phi of y, now without the index bare. Okay? And what we get is that, let me write, and you are not in the blackboard, you can probably see easier if it's more correctly if it's true or not. But what we get, if I did no mistake, with a normalization is that you should get this. So did I do a mistake now? Can you see, are the signs okay? And I can go and check and so on, but you can do it immediately. Is it correct or not? Should I? Okay, I'll see it. So we got 1 plus lambda, 1 minus lambda. So I pass to the other side, becomes 1 plus lambda fiber. I have twice 2, and then I have a minus gamma, which affects this. Yeah, it's okay. Okay, so you can very easily see that this statement, this is absolutely equivalent to that statement there with the bare stuff. Sorry? What happened to the cutoff? It is now here. This is forever. Is it clear? Is someone confused with the math before I explain the physics? Is the math clear? So what is happening here? We are seeing that the operators that have finite correlation functions are not the ones that appear in the Lagrange, and are not the bare Lagrange, not the bare fields, but are some renormalized fields. And these renormalized fields, how do they differ from the bare fields? They differ by multiplying by cutoff to some quantum correction, to some gamma times lambda. So you are multiplying by a power of the cutoff. So cutoff is a dimension full thing. Cutoff has dimensions, it has centimeters or pounds. How do you say centimeters in this funny thing? Inches or whatever. Yeah. So this lambda, it has centimeters, right? So this is a dimension full quantity. And then you have a dimension full quantity to some power. And phi has a bare dimension itself. So now this full object has a new dimension. If this has dimension delta zero, the full object has dimension delta zero plus gamma lambda. So in the same way that by dimensional analysis, I could say that right away, the correlation function should be proportional to that. Now by dimensional analysis, I can say that phi with phi ought to be this. I mean, by dimensions, it could not be anything else. But what we see here is the following, is that there is a direct connection. There is a really totally direct connection between multiplicative renormalization and the spectrum of anomalous dimensions. So if I multiplicatively renormalize, which is something I have to do in any CFT to define what are my physical operators, in the process, I can read off also the dimensions. Because when I renormalize a field, I define new fields with a different dimension. And then I just know that what this is going to be the correlator. OK? So in other words, so in practice, this means that the spectrum is related to the log divergences of the two-point function of bare operators. So if I start studying correlation functions of bare operators, I just look at the log divergences, at how they diverge. And if I have some experience, I read off immediately, oh, it diverges like this. OK, this is the anomalous dimension. I mean, I can continue to the end, but I know already what's going to happen. I can, you see, that the anomalous dimensions are captured by the logarithmic divergences of the two-point functions. Is it clear? Good. Now, in n equals 4, things are a bit more complicated. Because now, we don't have one operator. We have an O there. OK? So we consider, so let's add here an important index A. Let's do some capital A like this, where this A indicates what kind of fields we are putting. And of course, it's a big label. For a given fixed dimension, a given fixed, say, 5 total fields in total, there are many things I can do. 5 scalars, 5 fermions, 5 whatever. I have a huge set of things I can do. OK? So there is a big, so specifying an A is like specifying what M1 I'm using and so on. OK? So it means that the starting point, in general, what we did is way too oversimplified. By the way, I suspect that most people have seen this before. Right? This is the standard treatment. This is in Peskin. I'm sure when you did RG in a way or another, you saw that the renormalization of operators was related to their scaling dimension. This, by the way, is true not only in CFTs. It's true also that if you have in any generic field theory, you also have dimensions of operators. The dimensions of the operators govern the ultraviolet behavior and the points are very similar, very close to each other. So you also have a gamma governing a general correlation function in a general quantum field theory, but it's a scale-dependent gamma, and it enters Kalman-Zeemansky equation that tells you how things change with scale and so on. And in particular, it tells you that when the points are very, 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 very close, which means that you are at super high energy, so it means that you are in an effective CFT. It tells you what's the spectrum of dimensions of that effective CFT. Okay, so anyway, so this is kind of standard thing. What people typically don't mention is that it's often the case, not always, but often, as you see, for example, if you have an unabelian gauge theory, it's more or less always the case. But even beyond that, it's often the case that you have degeneracy, that there are more than, there are several fields that have the same classical dimension, and you have to understand what happens in that case. Okay? So we have a huge degeneracy. In general, we can have a huge degeneracy of fields with the same quantum numbers. Of course, if ones are fermions and other are bosons, we can distinguish very well. But even with the same quantum numbers, for example, even just made out of scalars, but with the same quantum numbers and same classical dimension. Right? For example, we can have trace of phi 1, phi 1, phi 2, phi 1, phi 2, and trace of phi 1, phi 1, phi 2, phi 2, phi 1. These two guys, they are different, but they have the same classical dimension. What's the classical dimension of this guy? Now we are in n equals 4, and this phi is one of the six scalars in n equals 4. By the way, you might be confused that I runs from 4 to 9. I said there, I don't want I to run from 4 to 9. It's just notation, but I want that I to run from 1 to 6. I will never remember if it goes from 4 to 9. Okay, it just doesn't matter. So you have one of the six scalars there, and I construct these two operators, and they both have the same delta zero, which is, someone tell me, in this case, what's the classical dimension of this object?
Sorry? I hear no numbers at all.
Five.
Which is five. We have five scalars. But each is
a dimension one. So this would be dimension five. You see, it's very clear in perturbation theory. So the propagator between a scalar and another scalar, what would it be? It would be 1 over x minus y square. Between scalars of different type, it would be 0. Right? And to leading order in perturbation theory, when we compute a two-point function of two such guys, all we do is we unite them by propagators. For example, it could be, You understand this picture? I chose green to indicate phi 2. Green is probably hard to see. Let me use a different color. I chose a... And this is all we do. We just put five propagators. So this quantity is proportional to 1 over x minus y squared. And there are five such propagators. So delta 0 is just 5. I just read off what delta 0 is. Okay, that's what the three-level computation would give me. But now as we go to loops, this is one OA, this is another OA. What happens? So let's see what happens as we go to loops. I'll do it there. Now, what happens? I start with my OA and OB. Okay. We can put some index there. Now, what will we get? We will get 1 over, by dimension, it will be 1 over x minus y to the power 2 delta 0. This is the dimension of the left-hand side, so the right-hand side must be this. Right? Now, as we see here, for example, if I take this operator and on the other side I put this, of course I get 0 because they cannot connect. So I need the same thing here and here. The line just goes through. Right? You agree? So I start at, if I don't put any coupling, the theory is just free, and I have delta AB. Same spin chain on the bottom, same spin chain on the top. So I'm already using this language of spin chain because I think of each of the bottom and the top as being a spin chain, just up, up, down, up, down. But it's just my taste. I can say each string goes to each string. Okay, each operator goes to each operator. And then there could be a divergence. That could be a divergence that I would parameterize by saying minus lambda times some divergence that could depend on operator A and B. Okay? And that divergence would come with a logarithm of gamma square x minus y square. Right? And this divergence, nothing obliges me to be proportional to delta AB. And now, how do I do? How do I proceed in this case? This looks a little bit more complicated now. So how do I proceed? Sorry? So what I want is to use what we saw before. I would like to try to reduce it, if I could, to this case. But I have this case with the instances A and B. So what could I do to reduce it, to simplify it and make it not more complicated than what we have seen before? So when you have a matrix and want to get rid of the matrix and simplify our life, what do? You diagonalize it. So the first step would be, let's introduce some O bare A, and let's make a combination with some coefficients. Let's call it psi A. Let me call this wave function. And let me fix these coefficients, fix this wave function coefficients, okay? Okay. Such as to diagonalize, let this combination be O A diagonal, still bare, okay? Let it diagonalize this matrix gamma AB, okay, with eigenvalue gamma A. Okay, this gamma AB is a matrix that acts on an operator, gives another operator, it defines a big matrix, and we diagonalize it. Okay, so if I think of that as a matrix, so I have that the gamma times this O diagonal is equal to some gamma A times O diagonal. Okay? But then, if I consider these combinations that diagonalize this matrix, then for these combinations, I get that O diagonal bare of X, the same thing at Y, with an index A and with an index B. Now I diagonalize, so I get delta AB that I can pull out in front. And then I get 1 minus lambda, the dimension, the eigenvalue of corresponding to this eigenvector, times log. But now it's exactly the same as before, right? Now it's exactly the same as before. So now I just take this operator and define my O physical, I don't put any label, O A of X to be cut off to the power of this eigenvalue, gamma A, times this particular diagonal and bare operator of X. Okay? This is definition. And with this definition, correlation functions of O A of X, O B of Y, they just give delta AB over X minus Y to the power 2 times the full quantum dimension delta A, which is delta 0 plus lambda gamma A. Yes?
B are the sets of the fields I put in the operators, right?
Yeah.
So you're summing over A over there in the...
Yeah.
When you diagonalize the...
Yeah,
the,
I write a combination. For example, this would be one operator, this would be another operator. And I make a linear combination. I put alpha times this guy plus beta times this guy plus gamma times another guy and so on. And I find this alpha, beta, gamma and so on such that... So for each pair of such guys, I compute a matrix element. So I have a big matrix. And then I diagonalize this matrix. And a this will give me a particular linear combination that I call O diagonal. Once it is diagonalized, it's the same story as before. Because once you diagonalize, you reduced it to just the eigenvalues, one problem per eigenvalue. So the summary is quite simple. In general, here is what we have to do. Step one is we compute the bare correlation function between two operators, OA and OB. Okay? And we extract this matrix gamma AB from the log, the coefficient of log lambda. So we don't even need the full thing. The log lambda is typically the easiest one to detect because it's divergent. So we just study this two-point function, see how it diverges, and go and read off the coefficient of log lambda, and this is our matrix. Step two, you diagonalize this matrix. And that's it. Now you extract information. The eigenvalues now are nothing but the spectrum of anomalous dimensions that we wanted. And the eigenvectors tells you what are the operators, the good linear combinations that have definite anomalous dimensions. Because if you consider a linear combination of two operators, it's an object that you can still compute correlation function, but it does not have a definite anomalous dimension. When you compute correlator of this, you'll get the sum of several power laws.
So if you're doing this, you need to kind of get a full set of the OAs and OBs
to make sure you can generate this entire gamma AB.
Very good. So let's do it. So let's go now and run off this to see how it works in practice. Otherwise, it remains something a bit. A bit mysterious, and it should not be. So let OA now. As Tom is saying, let's consider a set of OAs. And let me tell you what it is, and we will see that in perturbation theory, it's clear that this is a complete set to this loop order that we are working in. So I want to consider not all operators in n equals 4, that's too complicated, but they close into sectors. So if I put an operator, for example, that has an odd number of fermions, it's not going to mix it something with an even number of fermions because I can measure fermion numbers. So it's clear that they organize into different sectors. You can measure different charges, different quantum numbers, and they shouldn't mix. And the claim is that at this loop order, the following operators are already interesting enough. Let's consider operators where I take a scalar and many scalars, L such scalars, where this I here can go from 1 to 6. It's already very general. So now specifying an A is specifying a set of indices I1 up to IL. Okay? So A takes 6 to the L values. Right, because for A, I have to specify an index from 1 to 6 for each I. So it's big. It will be a big matrix. The matrix gamma AB will be 6 to the L by 6 to the L matrix. Okay? So this object is equal to this in our double line notation. Okay, and we have another one. This is our A, and then we will have our B, and then we will have our B here, and we want to study this two-point function and extract its log lambda divergence. Okay, so the term I want to start studying, and because it's, as I will see, the only term that matters. So let's start. They need to. Otherwise, it is not possible. They fall in different classes. So the question is whether A and B need to have the same classical dimension. They do. Otherwise, this formula would not make sense. You see, you cannot have the, you see, it's impossible. Delta zero there is the same. Otherwise, the starting point already, even at when you turn off the coupling, you could not connect them. Right? So these operators, the lines from one operator need to go to the other operator. These are normal ordered operators. You cannot self-contract. So you start with some lines, they go to the other one. Okay? So, but that's a good point. So they have the same length L, which is also the classical dimension of the field. And let's start by considering the effect. We want to do a one-loop diagram, right? We want to do a one-loop computation. Let's start by considering the effect of the quartic vertex of the scalars. Okay? So we will have scalars coming in, they interact with the quartic vertex, and they come out. Now, what is this quartic vertex that I represent here in a picture? Right. What is this quartic vertex? Well, this trace of this guy square is equal to what? It's equal to twice phi I, phi j, phi I, phi j, minus twice phi I, phi j, phi j. So this is just a statement that if I compute that square, when I have phi I phi j minus phi j phi I and I square that, I have two possibilities. Either I get ij ij alternating, or ii followed by jj. Okay? So that means that there are two kinds of vertices. One is like this one here, where I have two i's and then followed by two j's. And one where I have the reds opposing each other and the whites opposing each other. So this gives rise to two types of vertices. So here I have, and then I can use a different color to indicate that here, this is how I would draw. Now I'm not doing it fat, but I'm doing it with color to indicate the index. And here the color would be like this. Is it clear? This is just from the point of view following the index. They need to be planar. So this is how the index go, and this is what we are interested now, is how the index goes. So what we conclude is that when we consider the effect of this vertex we have a big correlation function, and we are considering the effect of this vertex. Okay? And let me tell you what happens. What happens is that we can get, let me write and then we see if we agree. We get the following. If this is index, let's write this as being index i1, i2, j1, j2. We get the sum, we get the following. Let me write and then you'll see. We get, I will write an equation and a picture and then we will see if we agree with both. 4 times this minus 2 times this minus 2 times this, whereby these pictures, I mean, this is all from the point of view of indices, 4 delta I, okay, so what is happening here? What's happening here is that clearly what happens is that the indices are conserved. So if I have i1, i2, here I have a couple of possibilities. One possibility, according to these vertices, is that this line goes here and this line goes here. Okay, this comes from this vertex over there, the first one, and that gives a factor of 4. Because I can put the vertex in two different orientations and it gives rise to the same thing. Okay. Whereas this one here, where they are neighbors, okay, what's important is that there are two possibilities. Either I put a vertex like this and it gives rise to something like this, or I rotate the vertex and I use it to construct this. So the same vertex has to split itself and give rise to this contribution and this contribution, whereas that one just gives rise to this kind of tensor structure. Is it clear? So what I want to emphasize, very important, not the overall coefficient, but the relative coefficients. Do you agree with the relative coefficients? That's what is going to be important. Okay, so this is the point of view of the indices. So from the point of view of the indices, we agree, but it's not the full story. So it's not the full story, so let me tell you what we get. So we get in total that this graph here, when they contract each other, then they interact here, and then they go on, is equal. This is from the 4 vertex of the scalar that we are doing. Okay. And what do we see that we are getting? Well, we are getting g Young Mill square times n coming. Why do I put this g square times n? Why this power of n? This is the power of n compared to not having this interaction, because compared to the lines going vertically, where I have one loop of n, now I get two loops of n, so I get an extra n compared to before. Okay. So, and if you see powers of Jiang Mills, you also get an extra Jiang Mills. And this is because this is a one loop effect. So this is just a lambda. Good. Then we get that tensor structure that we wrote there. Namely, we get this structure plus this structure minus twice this structure. Okay? There is an overall constant that I don't care about. This is normalization. This position can be n and n plus 1. And then I should sum over all these possibilities happening at n and n plus 1, where all other indices just go straight. But this happens at position n and n plus 1. And this is, of course, multiplied. We still have to do the loop diagram. What's the loop diagram? We integrate over the position of the vertex, d4z, Okay. And then we have a propagator going from X to Z. Okay. This Z is the position of this vertex here that we are integrating over. We integrate from X to Z, and there are two such propagators, right? Two propagators going from the bottom, this propagator and this propagator, and two propagators going to from Z to Y. So Y minus Z square times all other propagators that go directly from bottom to top, right? These ones. Right? All other propagators that just go directly that we are not interested in. Okay. Now we want to study the behavior of this integral, how it diverges. So when does this integral diverge? It diverges if Z, if the interaction point approaches X, or if Z approaches Y. Right? So this is divergent for Z, for the interaction point going to X or Y. So let's suppose it goes to X. If it goes to X, I'm zooming close to Z equal X, but then this part is totally regular. I can here just replace Z by X and take it out of the integral. Right? Close to Z equal X, this is a slowly changing factor. I can put Z equal X and take it out. So close to Z equal X, I get 1 over X minus Y square. I just put Z equal X here. Times the integral d for Z over X minus Z to the power 4. Now I go to radial coordinates around the point Z equal to X. So this is approximately equal to an integral r cubed dr over r to the 4, if I compute in radial coordinates around the point z equal r. And as you see, if I integrate up to some cutoff 1 over r, this is log divergence, and this gives log lambda, because there is a 1 over r. Okay? So we see very easily, and if you want, what will be the natural ir cutoff? Well, this, I'm zooming close to X equal Y, so the natural IR cutoff would be X minus Y. So I would get the natural cutoff X minus Y. Okay? So in total, what do we see? We see that all this stuff here, what does it generate? All this stuff, all this part over there, generates the three-level propagators times log lambda, times log of cutoff, up to some constant, of course. Okay? Because you see that this factor that we took out were the two missing propagators, these two missing one here. These two missing propagators are exactly this term that we took out. So this is just two propagators. So we reconstruct all the propagators times a log lambda. So we conclude that this here, with the sum, is part of our matrix gamma. What part? It's the part of gamma coming from the vertex. Okay? Good. But now, now the good news is that all other terms are irrelevant in a particular sense. Because now I want to claim the following. I want to claim, therefore, that my matrix gamma, which has indices what? I1 up to IL, let this be incoming indices. And the outgoing indices, let me put them upstairs, J1 up to JL. Right? This is my matrix gamma AB. What am I claiming? I'm claiming that this matrix is just some constant times lambda. So this is just a numerical constant. If you want, I can tell you that it is, this constant is 1 over 16 pi square. These pi's and so on come, if you are careful about the pi's in the propagators, the spherical element, blah, blah, blah. Times, and now I represent this by just saying that I have a sum over n, and then I just put a bunch of vertical lines indicating delta Kronecker's up to some position. And at that position, I have this interaction minus twice this interaction. This is what we computed so far, plus some other constant that I don't know what it is, let me explain why, times the term where all of them go straight. So that's the claim. And the claim is the following, is that if you think a little bit, you will see that all other diagrams, they cannot change the indices, incoming and outgoing indices. For example, suppose we think about this diagram here, where we exchange a gluon. Gluons don't carry this color index I from 1 to 6. So if I change a gluon, if I have an index I must have the same index I. And if I have an index j, I must have the same index j. These diagrams, for example, they can give a log lambda, but they must contribute here only to this constant times the identity. Other diagrams that could be divergent. For example, diagrams where I start doing one loop diagrams like this, or like this, or putting a bubble of fermions. But all these diagrams, again, by conservation, these are proportional to delta ij, all these diagrams. So all these one loop diagrams that only affect one line by conservation of this symmetry, they also only contribute here. So it's immediate looking at the action that the only graphs that have the potential of swapping the indices are the ones coming from the commutator square. Okay? Hence, this follows. But now, let's conclude. So what did we achieve? We achieved something quite nice, because this is nothing but the kind of spin chain Hamiltonians that we were seeing in the lectures. What we can conclude is the following. Let me write what is the conclusion. The conclusion is, consider, let's think of our operators, trace of phi I1 up to phi IL. Let's think of this as an SO6 spin chain, where I have my ket with I1 up to IL. Right? Then we have here the statement that we have some matrix gamma, I1, IL, J1, JL. And the statement here would be that we can construct a spin chain Hamiltonian, which would be this lambda over this numerical constant, if you want, that's not important. And then it would be a sum from n equal 1 up to L, up to the length, of what? Of this guy, which you remember was what we call trace operator, minus the other one, which is twice the permutation, plus some constant, but that's irrelevant because it's just an overall shift of the energy times the identity. And what we just showed today was that the spectrum of this spin chain Hamiltonian, today we established that computing the one loop spectrum of this operator's gamma is nothing but finding the spectrum of this Hamiltonian. This is what we saw here. We just have an Hamiltonian which takes some incoming indices on this Hilbert space of 6 to the L by 6 to the L dimensions. It was written somewhere. Right? The 6 to the L is just the dimension of this Hilbert space. Right? This belongs to some Hilbert space of 6 to the L dimensions. And what we saw is that we automatically have a matrix. This matrix that we compute in perturbation theory, because we are in the planar limit, at most the spins can change by can be the nearest neighbor interaction. And indeed, we find the spin chain with nearest neighbor interaction between sites n and plus 1 with some precise coefficients between the trace, the permutation, and the identity. Okay, let me just remind you what the trace is. The permutation, you remember, you take AB, you get BA. The trace acting on AB gave delta AB times sum from C equal 1 up to 6 of CC. It is this annihilation that produces this. So the conclusion is that instead of computing Feynman diagrams and doing these complicated one-loop diagrams, we just need to diagonalize and compute the spectrum of this nearest neighbor spin chain. Okay? But now comes something nice, even nicer. This is already nice because we mapped our problem in four dimensions to now a one-dimensional problem. But now you can open your notes because now we can ask ourselves, we got an SO6 spin chain. That was trivial from the beginning. Of course, it was going to be a nearest neighbor spin chain. That's planarity. Of course, it was going to have SO6 symmetry because the theory has a symmetry of rotating these scalars. But what is non-trivial is what's the coefficient between trace and permutation, which we derived. It was coming from this commutator. And it is the ratio between the two is 1/2, minus 1/2. And if you remember, of all SO6 spin chains, one was special. And it was the one where the ratio was minus 1/2. Only with that ratio, the spin chain was going to be integrable. So what we saw is that we get that the one-loop spectrum of anomalous dimension in n equals 4 super Young-Mills is equivalent to computing the spectrum of an integrable spin chain. Yes?
You say one loop, but because of conformal invariance, this is protected under further quantum corrections. I mean, at least the dimensions, right? Because
no.
It isn't?
No, there is no such statement that one loop results are exactness yet.
No. Sure, but I'm saying that just the gammas, well, I mean, they don't run the. Or do they?
The gammas, they are non-trivial functions of lambda. Okay, so in general,
what will happen is that we will have this Hamiltonian to diagonalize. But if you do two loops, now you get plus an extra term with next to nearest neighbor interaction, plus one with longer range, longer range, longer range. So gammas, they have an expansion. These gammas, they are lambda times gamma at one loop, plus lambda squared times gamma at two loops, plus ta ta ta. So if you would start doing higher perturbation theory, you get now lambda square terms times log square and so on, and they all resum to giving this. There is no difference. So they both govern the ultraviolet behavior of a correlation function, which is the definition of what is the dimension. It's the object that when you zoom in tells you that all correlators, when you put phi x, phi y, goes like 1 over x minus y to some critical exponent. That's the definition in the general conformal quantum field theory. In a CFT, that's the behavior at all scales because there's no scale. So if you know what happens when the distances are very close, you know at all distances. So the claim is that in any large n gauge theory, there is a map between the spectrum of operators, the one loop spectrum of anomalous dimensions, and the spectrum of a one-dimensional spin chain. You see, we use the example of n equals 4, but I hope that this is very that it's clear that it is very general. Again, the fact that it is local is planarity, and the fact that you can map it to a spin chain is just by the nature of being a trace of something which is a cyclic object. Okay? What is amazing here is not that we get a spin chain, not that we get nearest neighbors, not that we get SO6 symmetry, but that the coefficient of K and P is minus 1/2, which is exactly the coefficient that we saw, guarantees that we have an integrable spin chain. So suddenly this problem that was very complicated, that we had a 6 to the L by 6 to the L space of operators with, and we have to do all these Feynman diagrams and so on, is reduced to a problem that we can just write a bunch of bit equations and solve it completely. Okay, so this was a lot of material. I think we need a good summary on Monday. And on Monday now, we go and try to study the implications and see where this fits in a bigger framework of ADS-CFT. Okay.